Welcome to Spirit in Action. My name is Mark Helpsmeet, and each week we bring you visits and conversations with people doing healing work for this world, hearing what they're doing and what inspires them and supports them in doing it. Welcome to Spirit in Action. Today for Spirit in Action, we welcome back Pamela Haynes. Pamela writes deep and profound and life-changing books, but she does it with simple, straightforward, and accessible language. With degrees in social ecology and labor and women's history, she is a self-taught economist and consummate communicator. Her greatest strength, however, is not her paper degrees, but her genuine and lifelong curiosity, integrity, and wide-ranging compassion, which lead her to write delightful books that all of us need and can appreciate. Today we consider her 2022 book, Tending Sacred Ground, Respectful Parenting, and her 2023 book, The Promise of Right Relationship. Thanks to Andrew Jansen for production assistance on today's program. Pamela Haynes joins us via Zoom from Philadelphia, PA. Pamela, it's wonderful to have you back again for Spirit in Action.
So glad to be here. Thank you for having me.
It's been a lot of years, 2017 to 2024, that's 7 years. You've written at least a few books in that time. Any other big events in your life you care to bring our listeners up to date on?
Well, I think maybe the big thing is poetry. I started publishing poetry, so that's pretty exciting. And I have now 3 volumes. I'm noticing that some writing goes well in the essay format, but some just needs a poem, or some insights. Some just needs a poem, so that's been fun.
Is that related at all? Your BA was in social ecology. And I'm thinking that somehow you access social ecology through poetry.
I think there's something about connections. Like, that was my reason for the BA. Like, how do you connect people and places and life? And what are the networks? How do you kind of do that networky thing? And I think that poetry allows you to do that maybe more easily than prose.
When I was reading the 2 books, Tending Sacred Ground and The Promise of Right Relationships, I was wondering what your educational background was that got you to there. So that's why the social ecology thing popped up. And labor and women's history. And I said, wait a minute. My wife is always amazed. I think there's a New York Times quiz that comes out each week, and they give you one event, and then they give you another and say, in time, is it before or after? And you do this, I don't know, 7 or so of them. And she's just amazed that I can put the ideas together. Well, yeah, I think that happened back then, and that was probably around the 12th century. And she says, how can you possibly know that? Because I was a math major. I was a computer science physics major. But I have a feeling that labor and women's history, social ecology, those exactly prepare you to do these kind of books. Do you see that as a natural evolution in your abilities?
I had never thought about that at all. But I really did use my college opportunities to explore reality. Now, what's really going on? And I think that's true. What's connected to what? And so then with that MA, I focused more on the U.S. and who's engaged in what and how does it connect. Yeah, maybe so. Maybe so.
The first book we're going to talk about is Tending Sacred Ground, Respectful Parenting. And I think, I mean, you refer regularly in here to how you've worked with kids. Of course, your own kids, grandkids, but other kids. What is your experience for our listeners?
Well, I have 2 biological children and a number who call me mother that I've accumulated over the years. And I've also worked in kind of family play community where people will get together once a week or once a month, the parents and the children and some other folks, just to play hard and for the children to get a chance to have some really good attention on their own terms. And so that's been a place where I've had a lot of experience as well.
First thing I want to observe about both of the books before we talk about Tending Sacred Ground is I really love the very simple and direct way that you go to stories. You tell something that happened, an experience in your life, something you observed, and then you talk about the meaning of it, your experience with it, your thoughts about it, the consequences of it. And in some ways, it feels a little bit like parable telling or something. You have the parable story, and then you have your lesson from it. But your lessons are always open-ended, as opposed to those who say, see, you do this, and that's the way you get to justice. And you don't do that. Talk a little bit about what formed you to write that way.
If you think of yourself as a learner in this world, then you're always observing and finding out what you can learn from what you observe and then what the next step is. Like you notice and then you make a hypothesis about what you noticed and then you try something on the basis of that hypothesis, then you get more information and then you readjust. So it really does feel like that's the only way that you can really engage with reality, with integrity, by being willing to pay close attention and try to make meaning out of what you experience and apply that in some way and then pay more attention.
So the key words in what you just said, from my point of view, I was just making a list of them. You talk about integrity, you talk about attention. These are key values that are part of the background that so clearly influences what you write in your books. Where did those come? Because some people get that kind of thing out of having a rigorous scientific education. You know, this cause, effect, draw the lines, do logic carefully. I sense that may have been part of your background, but not the major part.
No, it wasn't really. But I do like that idea, the scientific idea of observing and making hypotheses and trying things and observing. So I think that's really sound. But I think it's probably my Quaker upbringing, you know, reaching for truth and acting with integrity and the idea that revelation continuously unfolds, that we can't be sure that anything is going to be the last word because life is continuing and revelation is continuing.
And also a key in Quaker practice, as you and I have experienced it, and mind you, we're halfway across the country from one another, is asking questions. Not questions with a right or wrong answer, but questions that cause one to reflect and examine within.
Yes.
Your stories do that. You don't come out with, no, this is the right answer. You got to do it this way, which so many instructional manuals for kids or something will tell you, you know, this is the right way. Do you just live a life of doubt?
No, I would say I live a life of connection and paying attention. I don't think of it as doubt. I just think of it as not being that interested in a final answer. I think people who give advice are just on such thin ice because everybody is so different and their context is so different and their history is so different that, you know, my good advice for me might be terrible advice for you. So I would not ever want to give advice. I just think that's a flawed approach. I would listen hard and then offer a possibility, but I wouldn't do it without having a chance to listen first.
You know, I've been part of actually two weekly men's groups since 1991, so 23 years in this group. And one of the fundamental rules is we don't give advice. Unless a man specifically asks for a piece of advice, we don't give advice. It creates such a different dynamic when we're not trying to fix someone else's problems, presuming we have the answers. And I have a feeling that it makes learning much easier and much more powerful.
Oh, yeah, yeah. You know, I was listening to somebody sharing some remarks recently, and one of the things that he said is when you think you know, that's when you're set up to do harm.
Yeah. I want to have some deep philosophical questions about that. And I really do appreciate that the books are short, the stories are digestible. Could you share with us a reading from Tending Sacred Ground by Pamela Haynes so our listeners have some idea what to look forward to if they get a hold of one of these books?
I will be glad to. This is a selection called Peekaboo. How often have we played that game with our own children, grandchildren, nephews and nieces, neighborhood children, babies that we don't even know at the checkout line, at the grocery store, on the bus? It may be called different things in different places, but its theme is universal and eternal. I must have played Peekaboo 1,000 times before I ever noticed what the game was really about. It happened at a workshop when I just met somebody new. We liked each other right away, found a topic of mutual interest without difficulty, and were chatting away happily. Then came a lull in the conversation, one of those pregnant pauses, when our eyes met, when we both had to notice that the other one was really there. How excruciatingly embarrassing. Luckily, we were both on the same wavelength. We looked and laughed and hid our faces, looked again, and laughed and laughed. It was a classic game of peekaboo. No wonder the game is a classic. It's all about the most basic questions in human relationships. Are you there? Are you really there? Will you be there next time? Do you see me? Do you really see me? Are you pleased to see me? Will you be pleased to see me next time? Not only do you get a chance to ask all those important questions, you get to laugh and laugh as the answers come back, a great and wonderful string of unqualified yeses. Ultimately, peekaboo is a game about noticing, about being there. To be played successfully, both players must have their full attention on the game. This, I think, may be its greatest attraction. Any child who is playing peekaboo has secured another person's undivided positive attention, one of the most scarce and valuable resources of all. No wonder children love the game. And no wonder we adults find it such an embarrassing game to play with each other. In the course of our childhood and growing up, we've gotten enough no's in response to all those questions that they often seem like pretty scary ones to ask. I think of all the hundreds of times I've turned my children down. No, other things are more important. No, I don't have time for you. No, I would rather not be bothered. No, you'll have to manage by yourself. It's not surprising that we found lots of ways to avoid risking those no's. We don't ask. We go off by ourselves. We lower our eyes. We change the subject. We deflect a joke. We discover important work that needs to be done. But peekaboo is a great game. I have a new appreciation of why children want to play, and I'd like to see it played even more, with all sorts of variations for different ages. What if every child riding on a bus, every child waiting in a line, got to play peekaboo? What if that were just the beginning? The more yeses we can get to those basic questions, and the more we can laugh in wonder and delight at all the yeses, the better off all of us will be.
So have you tried to do it more with adults since you wrote that and since you thought about that?
I think I do. I think it's like I'm willing to risk the embarrassment and be the first one to notice that we're noticing each other. Yeah, I think so. I think maybe a little bit unintentionally, which is probably a good thing.
I think anyone who knows Pamela Haynes knows that they can give you an experience, a starting point, and you're going to be able to reflect on it, find additional aspects, information, insights into it. So I've got a little game that I innovated with my granddaughters in particular. I've got three granddaughters who live right here in town. So when I would see them, I would go along with my fingertip and I would go, and you know, there's the thing where you jump in and you surprise them. Well, I would do this and I'd move the finger all around and they'd watch the finger very closely until it gets closer to the nose. When I touch their nose, I go beep and I jump up. And they loved it. And they each looked forward to it each time I would be around. And the thing that I found very interesting was as that finger got closer and closer to the nose, frequently they'd lean in with their nose to reach my finger. I say, no, wait, no, what is that? Is that ending suspense? Is that making connection? What it was? So I'm giving you that one. You're writing about it now, and maybe it's an additional chapter to tending sacred ground, respectful parenting. What do you get from that?
Well, I think it's the attention. You know, they've got your undivided attention. That's the thing. I think that's the gold that we keep reaching for. Undivided, positive, appreciative attention. I don't know. I think I can just imagine them joining in the game. And that's one active thing they can join in the game is to move their nose a little closer.
It is really fun to do that with them. And you can do it with a child very young. Mm-hmm. There's one thing that I questioned after I finished reading Tending Sacred Ground, Respectful Parenting. My question was, why is it cultivating respect? Why isn't it about cultivating safety or power, intelligence, order, insight? There's many other things that you could have chosen to culture, to have your parenting be. Just parenting, right? Justice parenting. Why is respectful? And I have a sense of where this comes from because I'm also Quaker, but I have a feeling for a lot of other people, that wouldn't be the first step, respectful.
Yeah, I think maybe that's why, I mean, that's one of the reasons why I use that word, because it's not a word that people often, it's probably not that off, I don't know, in like how-to parenting manuals. But it just seems to me that without respecting that individual kind of in all of their wonder and uniqueness and goodness, if you don't start with that essential attitude of respect, then there's a way that you're just not on solid ground, I think.
I'm aware that you grew up as a woman in our society and I grew up as a man. And frequently, especially for parents, there's a different function for a father. One of the things that I've read and I've experienced firsthand is that often the role of the man is, sometimes it comes through the form of roughhousing. And there's wrestling or playing or some things that are tinged with danger. Whereas women, more often in our society, the idea is women provide safety and men provide risk and growth or something like that. Now, of course, nothing's 100%. And of course, there are women who do what men do in this generalization and men who do what women do in the generalization. I was, for example, the first one to change my son's diapers and to give him his bath and so on because I come from a large family. I've got all those experiences and his mother was an only child. So those different norms, I'd say, for genders in our society. How does that relate to what you're talking about in tending sacred ground?
I think we all have to be willing kind of to notice the places in us that really ring true, like good, fun, wrestling, just there's something that's just very right about it. And just listening attentively and having a child come and snuggle into your arms is something that's, there's just something really, really right about it. But I think we also have to be willing to stretch. There have been times when snuggles just didn't cut it. That wasn't what they were looking for. They were looking for something else. And I could wait for my husband to come home to do that, but it seems a pity to not give it a try. So I would encourage all parents to try things that maybe you weren't trained to do. Do the things that you were trained to do that ring true and do them often and well. But yeah, try it out.
Just sometime this past 24 hours, I watched a video and in it, there was a discussion going on about in the 1990s, what we call now helicopter parenting becoming the norm, extreme safety being the way that you have to watch your child and make sure they don't bump into any wall. And what I was just reflecting on that this morning and I said, now, wait a minute. If you eliminate the natural consequences of a child's action from their environment, the only guide they have is you. You make the consequences. You have a timeout, you know, like that. And I was saying, gee, that probably is, it's not good for the world, probably, and not good for the child.
Nope.
But, of course, you and I are similar ages, so that we grew up in a time when you kids were sent out and you take care of yourself. I mean, at least that was my situation. Of course, I come from a large family, so there's no way my parents are going to keep up with all of us.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think that safety is really important, but I think maybe it's emotional safety that's the more important one. That we do need to take risks in order to learn from them. But I think we need to know that we are loved and respected. And that provides a level of safety that probably, you know, at least in many situations, will have some relationship to physical safety as well. I think that people can make better judgments if they are kind of secure in their selves and in other people's sense that they're good and competent people. So I would say yes to safety, but I would say I would think of it as emotional safety rather than physical safety.
I remember the struggles I had. I thought it would be really wonderful if my son would learn to ride a bicycle. And he was relatively late in coming to that. And I remember working with him, getting him on a bicycle. And as long as I was running alongside with my hand on him, he's good. As soon as I removed my hand, he was going to freak out and tip the bike over right away. And it's not for lack of ability, but because his fear, I think, would overwhelm him. That's what it looked like to me. Of course, you can't push a child too much. I mean, there's much damage that comes from that. The other thing that he taught me when he was in second grade, I was really happy to see this. He came home from school one day, and he said to me, We did a run around the schoolyard today, and I think I was the slowest one in our class. There may have been one girl who was slower than me, but no, I think I was the slowest one. And he did that without any sense of shame, which told me I had raised him right.
Something right.
Yeah.
Yeah, congratulations.
It's a pretty rare situation, particularly for a boy who's most in our society get trained that they have to win, that they can't be the last, the loser. And I sprinkled throughout tending sacred ground, respectful parenting. You have observations related to that kind of thing. What do you think have been the gold standards that you've experienced for yourself, your light bulb moments, a couple of them that you could share?
So one of them is, I remember telling a friend, I can't believe that that child just did that. And then the light bulb was, if I can't believe that he did it, then how can I possibly respond to what he did? You know, that my disbelief is the thing that I've got to work on. I have to believe that he did it. Once I believe it, then I can think about it. Isn't that amazing? I never thought about that. I can't believe. How often do we say that? And then I think another one would be the question of who's having a problem here. Like, I imagine all parents have had this, you know, bedtime, children are kind of going a little bonkers and you're really tired and it's just not going well. And it's like, why are they not behaving? Like, why are they not going with the program? And then I realized that I'm actually the cranky one. I'm the one who's kind of impatient and my tone is harsh and they're doing their thing. And it's so easy to assume that it's the child who is the source of the problem rather than the context or sometimes me as the source of the problem. So I always, it's very, very helpful to me to remember that and to always have in mind the question of who is having a problem here and who is experiencing this as problematic and who is creating a problem. And that, again, puts me on much stronger ground to think about how to address. I mean, it is a problem. It needs to be addressed, but it kind of widens the lens a lot rather than just assuming that it's the child who is the problem. And that's another reason I think for that thing about respect. Like if my assumption is respect, then that kind of gives me a little buffer against the assumption that they're the problem.
And I think, Pamela, that that leads me to perhaps a significant portion of the next question I had for you, which is, so why did you write this book? How do you hope people use it? Who do you want it to go to? Tending Sacred Ground, Respectful Parenting, who is this for?
This is for people who have small children in their lives, or children, actually not small children, young people in their lives, and would love to be more present for them. I like the fact that it's not, you could pick it up anytime, like it could be in the bathroom, and the essays are really short, and I think that's good for busy parents. I wanted it to be stories so that people could say, oh, yeah, she knows something about my situation. So I think hopefully any parent could feel like they have some company, they have somebody else understanding the challenges that they're facing and offering some kind of hard-won insights and stories that might be of use.
In one of the chapters, you say, I would rather have a child who is good at wanting than a child that is good at giving up.
Mm-mm-mm.
And I think that's one of those deep seeds of wisdom. Could you explain that for our listeners?
I grew up not wanting. I came from a big family too, and there just wasn't space for everybody's wants to be addressed. And so I just decided that rather than risk disappointment and not having any way to handle that disappointment, I would just lower the bar. Don't want, don't get disappointed. You've got a little more control over the whole situation and you have a small life. And so just being open to what they actually want, it just feels like we get more of them. They show themselves more fully and we get to engage with really the richness of life. I don't know. It just seems right. It seems healthy. It seems like what I want. I want to be around people who want.
Passionate people instead of shut down and
conservative.
Fearful people.
Talk about risks. Wanting is a risk in the face of the possibility that you're not going to get it. Well, that's a risk that I'm really, really interested in inviting people to take. And then to, you know, you can be with them when they're disappointed. Yeah, it's so much more interesting. It's kind of like the difference between, you know, life is a kind of a flat line and life is a roller coaster. A roller coaster is much more exciting, you know? That's one.
Yeah. And for some people, Really, a roller coaster is far too terrifying.
Well, you know,
It's
there's
like,
little
no.
ones. You start with the little ones, so you know the.
Yeah, I remember when I was, it's for my 7th birthday, we went to an amusement park and I rode in a roller coaster. I'm sure from my adult point of view, it was a tiny roller coaster. But I remember saying afterwards, I was holding on with my toes. Oh my goodness.
Well, I mean, you don't want to take on more than you can manage, but just the idea that you get to have highs, that let's not sacrifice the highs for that straight line, the safety of the straight line.
You mentioned, Pamela, that you come from a large family. I know Lisa Lee and Deborah. I'm just wondering how large of a family,
We were six.
because I come from a Catholic family. We had 12 kids.
Oh, only half as many.
Yours is what we call a small family. Where were you in this whole?
I was the third girl, and there was a boy, girl, boy after me. And
And so Lisa Lee and Deborah, relative to you?
Deborah's older and Lisa's younger. And then so my eldest sister and my two younger brothers are not in that story.
Okay. Well, folks, today for Spirit in Action, we're speaking with Pamela Haynes. She's author of a number of books, including some of poetry, which I've never seen. So, Pamela, keep that in mind. The book we're talking about for the first half of this program has been Tending Sacred Ground, Respectful Parenting. It's in a series called Quaker Quicks, and I'll have links to connect you up with Pamela and those books on northernspiritradio.org. That's where your central information system always is. Northernspiritradio.org, a chance to comment on these interviews, to connect with, see the stations where we're broadcast nationally. Give us your feedback, suggestions for future gifts. There's also a place where you can donate. We do depend on you for our support, not on corporations or government, and that's a conscious decision. It has something to do with widening the view that our media can provide to you. So much of our media right now is owned, something like five or six companies control 90% of the audio and visual media in this country. It's far too limited and it can be steered by wealth. If you help us out, you help provide that diversity and you also help provide material then for the 35 or so stations nationwide that carry our programs. Community radio stations are wonderful. I'm imagining that in Philadelphia there have to be some really wonderful community radio stations, not just public radio, but community-owned.
Yes.
What have you got there?
Well, one in particular is up in Germantown. We used to have one here in West Philadelphia where I live, but it hasn't made it. So I'm sure there's other littler ones, but the one in Germantown really provides a very significant service to that part of our city.
Again, if you want to get a hold of Pamela Haynes and any of her books, where do people get a hold of all of these? Pamela, where would you direct them first?
I would direct them to bookshop.org, an alternative to Amazon, and they're all there.
I'll have to make my own visit to bookshop.org to make my own connections and have a good alternative. Let's continue on to the second book we want to talk about today, The Promise of Right Relationship. When I interviewed you back in 2017, we were talking about your book, Toward a Right Relationship with Finance. Again, you're a self-taught economist, but it grows naturally out of so many of the pieces that you've put together in your life, your social ecology, your labor, women's history. It fits together. And so that book, Toward a Right Relationship with Finance, leads me to the book that you wrote just this last year, The Promise of Right Relationship. So not right relationship with finance, just right relationship. Talk about that transition from one to the other. What are you including or excluding, or how are you focusing differently by talking about the promise of right relationship?
We left out one, which was the first book in the Quaker Quicks series, Money and Soul. That was a way to try to talk about economics in a way that infused values and kind of morality into a consideration of economics. So I think that's maybe the work that I do is around inviting people into a clearer understanding of economics and kind of being willing to claim that territory as our own and kind of walk into it boldly with our values intact. And I can't help noticing the world around me every day, and I am impelled to write about it. So I would say that the promise of right relationship is a much more general It's an essay collection that deals with a lot of topics. I'm totally passionate about the soil and urban agriculture, for example, and more of me maybe shows in The Promise of Right Relationship. But the idea of kind of getting to the roots, that's one of the reasons I started thinking about economics. There's so many problems, different varieties of problems. So then you get down to the roots, you've got economics, and then you get down even farther, you got finance in its role in economics. But there's getting to the roots in other places. And I think that right relationship is a way of thinking about that. How do you position yourself in relationship to anything really that you interact with in the world in a way, you know, it has integrity, or it, the way I am in the relationship to the way it is, there's something that is right about it. You get to be intentional in your relationships with economics, with the soil, with people, with oppression. There's all kinds of situations. So this is a pretty general look at that all-encompassing concept.
I'm kind of assuming, being the well-read and diversely interested person that you are, Pamela, that you've read Braiding Sweetgrass.
Oh my gosh. Oh my gosh.
And when you talk about relationship, I think about what she talks about in that book. It's the really very big picture about relationship. One of the advantages of your book is it's much smaller. It's less. It's fewer than 80 pages. Her book is much more engrossing, life-changing. You're going to sit in it for ages. Again, this one you can digest in our current day's life. People too seldomly allow themselves to sit and engross in an enlargement of understanding. I would like it if you would share a little reading from The Promise of Right Relationship that you released last year.
I'd be glad to. I've selected one that may be a surprise. I'm going to read Access to the Fast Lane. It's about our city expressway, page 61. Our city expressway is among the oldest in the nation, and our short local ramp is a challenge, providing easy access only at the best of times. Yet, it serves as an unexpectedly powerful metaphor on the relationship among speed, access, and equity in our world. When there aren't many cars on the expressway, there's no problem. The spaces are wide, cars on the ramp are already in motion, and anybody can find a way in. When there's more than enough to go around, everyone can get what they need. When the expressway is so crowded that everyone is already moving at a crawl, then those on the ramp simply edge in. The distinction between fast lanes and ramp has disappeared, and it's like one giant merge. Everyone takes it as a matter of course that they will have to yield to someone on the ramp. If we're all in the same situation, then we acknowledge our peerness and our common need and all work together to move forward. Yet, when the expressway is full of fast-moving cars, getting on from the ramp becomes an incredible challenge. Most of those who are zooming along pay no attention to the line waiting to get on. Moving speedily on their way, they're happy to be experiencing no difficulty and not inclined to make any for themselves. Even if someone would choose to make space when the passing lane is full, it's not easy to do. Slowing way down requires entrusting your safety to the reflexes of many drivers behind you, as well as incurring their wrath, and still may not offer a big enough gap for the cautious person on the ramp who has to proceed from a complete stop. The more speed some of us have, the harder it is for the slower ones to get in. In no way are those on the ramp less deserving of speed. Nor do we have any particular right to our speed. We just happen to be already on the expressway. Equity will only be achieved when the expressway becomes so crowded that no one has an advantage, or when those of us with the speed decide together that there are some advantages for us as well as for others in slowing down, or if we put resources into a massive redesign of the whole system to allow equal access to those fast lanes.
That is a perfect example of the deep and non-judgmental thought that you have. You're trying to observe the facts on the ground. You're not just going with the soundbite solutions that people have. You're asking questions. How do I do this? How do we do this? What can work? I think that shows an open spirit that I think is really helpful to make this world a better place. I was just reflecting this past weekend. We had our three of our granddaughters stayed overnight at our house on Saturday night. There's two of them who are 7 years old and one who's 12. One of the seven-year-olds seems to have some real deep insecurity. And I was trying to work with her on, she frequently says, they're not letting me do this. They're thinking bad thoughts about me. It happens way too much. And sometimes she cries, and I'm not quite sure where it's coming from because she's not getting less. She's the kind of child who says, well, she's got it. I want it. You know, it makes for difficulties. And so in terms of right relationship, I was trying to figure out what goal can I hold up to her, a measure that she could perhaps focus on otherwise that might be more helpful to her, leave her feeling less bereft, less needy, less, not irritate her relationships with other people. And the words that came to me was that we should live so that we increase the amount of love in the world. That's not an easy thing to do because there's so many levels and there's the momentary and there's the future and everything else. But I was wondering if she saw that differently, if her focus was taken from, I'm not going to get enough, to, are we going to get enough? And of course, just lecturing like that doesn't work. But I'm thinking all of us in the world, the whole capitalist system, which is predicated on having people think they don't have enough so that they better get more. You wrestle with all of these questions and much more on many levels. And I think that you've gotten to the point where you feel pretty good in your life, that you're living in a reasonable way. What have you changed in your life in terms of right relationship? And where are you changing in terms of right relationship?
Wow, interesting question. Well, I think that racial segregation is one that I faced fairly early in my life, and realizing that I was living in a bubble. And I was not in right relationship with my neighbors who were Black, for example, and trying to think about how do I get, you know, I need some access so that I can have some real life contact. And I made some decisions in order to get more access and then build on that. And it's been a steady project for a pretty long time, but I'm very pleased with having intentionally taken on that project and feeling like I've made some strides there. Right relationship. Well, you know, there's very intimate things. Like in my relationship, I'm in a long-term marriage with a guy, and I learned the art of being a really good martyr when I was a child. And, you know, martyrs kind of get points for the things that they give up or that they do that they don't want to do. And that isn't really right relationship with another human being. And so reorganizing my interior motivations, I don't know what you call it, so that I'm actually not doing things out of resentment. Like there's a path that I could go down that's resentment, and there's a path that I could go down that's just being present to what's happening right now and making the choice, recognizing that I'm at that fork and then making the choice. And that feels like that's a choice toward right relationship. So those are two pretty different thoughts that come to my mind about that. It's an interesting question.
But again, folks, when Pamela Haynes is talking about the promise of right relationship, this is relationship on so many different levels, micro and macro and internal, external. We're really looking at relationship in a better way for each and every one of us. And that's why when I had the idea, increase the amount of love in the world, mm-hmm. some people would say increase the amount of compassion. And I don't think that's quite right. Even though compassion is super important to me. For some people, it's a completely ignored value, and they think you're just a soft-hearted liberal if you have compassion for someone. But compassion isn't everything. And one of the things that, because I am a scientist at heart, my physics degree and having taught it even at university level, have a certain way of thinking. How do I follow one piece to another? And one of the questions for me was, is the most important thing we need to know about is survival? That is, it's been badly translated as survival of the fittest, but that which succeeds, succeeds. Maybe the supreme law is whether something actually succeeds. And that isn't just an individual, it can be the whole planet surviving. It could be a whole species surviving or multiple species surviving. You know, you can question that. But if it does not lead to survival in a wider sense, then I think that maybe we say that's a bad thing. But then on the other hand, if people weren't so numerous on this planet, maybe the planet would be in a whole lot better shape. I don't know. So there's a scientific part of me that goes in that direction as well. And that sometimes wrestles with my feelings towards compassion and increasing love in the world. Let's hear a little bit of the philosophy from Pamela Haynes.
Well, I'm not sure if I've got philosophy, but what you said about love and then right relationship made me think about the dilemma in our little community garden. I have a little plant there, and I have some ideas of things that I want to grow there. But there's also some plants that have their own ideas of their wanting to grow. And so how do you find your way amidst all of that? And I think love is a good grounding for that, that I start with a love of life, and I try not to just have my idea of who I should love. Like, we're going to love everybody, but we need to have some outcomes. And how can we kind of negotiate from a perspective of love? How can I pull weeds with love and compassion and then leave some things that I wouldn't have chosen there? I think there's something about right relationship in that process.
And folks, if you're reading The Promise of Right Relationship, you'll find all kinds of reflections that border on different aspects and parts of this. One that I had when I was speaking to someone recently, the liberal progressive end of the spectrum, which is my preferred home most of the time, people are very strongly concerned that we deal with immigrants compassionately and welcomingly, and that all of us of European descent were immigrants a couple generations or 10 generations back to this continent. And so we'll very rightly say that, no, immigration isn't bad, it's the way things are. But we'll go out and kill every invasive plant that we can, because whether it's the prickly ash or the poison ivy or just the other things we don't want in our garden. I say, wait a minute, is immigration okay or not?
Uh-huh, yeah. Where do we get to have mastery over? I mean, that's another really big question. And that's a question of right relationship, I think. Who do we get to be masters of?
And again, all kinds of reflections in Promise of Right Relationship related to that. One of the topics or a little point that you make is about goodness and falling short. Could you talk a little bit about that? That's a portion of The Promise of Right Relationship by Pamela Haynes.
Goodness and falling short. Well, you know, we're not perfect. And in a way, we have to have right relationship with our flaws and our shortcomings and our limitations. So both can be true, that we can be good and we can fall short at the same time. So that in a way, there's finding a right relationship right there. And just wanting to acknowledge that we're not talking about perfection here. We're talking about finding our way and sometimes having a clear idea of what's the right way of being or what's the right way of acting. That can get us in trouble as well. In a way, it's similar to the other one, the parenting thing. Like, if we can deal with the reality of the situation and bring what you were talking about, bring compassion to that reality, and then imagine that maybe there could be more. It's kind of a process of moving toward right relationships. I wanted to start really personally and really acknowledging that we fall short and that that's the reality of the human condition.
One of the reflections I've had over the decades I've been alive is that phrase, love your neighbor as yourself. A lot of people say, okay, I'm supposed to be compassionate about this neighbor, that neighbor. It says, wait, as yourself.
Yeah.
And wow, how many people trade one for the other instead of saying, no, we're all in the same bucket together. Yeah. As I went through The Promise of Right Relationship, again, Pamela, I love the way you write. It's so simple. It's not highbrow, complex. You're not going to have to add a whole additional vocabulary in order to gain from this. But my experience, again, you are already a friend from my point of view. I've met you in enough situations. We have common people that we love. So I've already valued you that way. In reading these books, you became a very close friend.
Oh.
I think that if we do that more with people in the world, we increase our circle of love in the world, it can only be good for us. One of the phrases that you said, again, I was so amazed. I actually read these books about a month ago and had other things busy, so I didn't get around to interviewing you till now. But over the last 4 or 5 days, I've had so many opportunities to engage with exactly the things you're talking about in this book. And one of them was the phrase, taking sides, taking stands. And you refer to the Union song, Which Side Are You On? Well, just this past week, I was engaging with exactly that phrase and that idea, and whose side are you on? Because it's so easy to write some people out and include some people in, and it doesn't lead to good things for the big picture. What are you talking about when you include that phrase? What are you thinking about?
Oh, I think it's everywhere, that there's something compelling about being on the right side. That it's kind of a shortcut, I think. It's like an easy shortcut that doesn't really get us to where we want to be. I don't think I had anything in particular. Well, you know, liberals and conservatives, I don't think it's really helpful to take a side. I'm on the side of the liberals, or I'm on the side of the conservatives. Like life is way more complex than that. And it feels like a shortcut that doesn't really service us very well. But if you think about taking a stand, where am I grounded? Where do I know that I'm on solid ground? Where am I in a place where how I am really rings true for me and doesn't cut me off from other people? I don't know. It just seems like that's way, way more interesting and way, way more what the world needs than trying to scope out which side has the most kind of virtue points and then claiming that one and discarding the other one. Doesn't seem very interesting or holistic or productive or wise. So I think, again, that's another one that we find ourselves taking sides, you know, take sides in an argument, take sides in a war, take sides in a union struggle, whatever. It's everywhere.
I think that power is a really important thing to understand. And there's power of all many different sorts.
Oh, yes.
I am concerned that politically right now there's a tilt in power that could be lethal to a lot of people. Wars are usually that way. We've got something that is not theoretically lethal, but I have a feeling for our society, it's a few steps down the road. So my question is, in terms of cultivating compassion for people who believe differently than me, and I'm usually pretty good at it, mind you. I can talk to people anywhere in the spectrum compassionately and learn something from them. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But it also could be dangerous because power can tilt in a way that can be harmful to so many people.
Yeah.
I feel like that in terms of the situation with Donald Trump. His narcissism, I think, does not allow him to see other people as valuable and important. And so giving power to someone like that, and there's plenty of other people of different varieties, it feels dangerous to me. So this balancing, you know, which side are you on? Well, I'm on the side of truth. Maybe I can say that one.
Well, you can take a stand there.
Yeah.
You can take a stand for truth.
Yes. I can take a stand for truth. I can take a stand for compassion without necessarily putting other people on the other side. Because one of the things that I found is a number of the evangelical supporters of Donald Trump, who I do not favor, that the evangelicals are some of the most compassionate people I know, just really friendly, generous people too. So I try not to paint people black and white based on which side I happen to be on.
Well, yeah, we want to vote and we want to decide which people or policies we would rather have in power. So there's that. Oh, I could go on about that too. But I think that we don't want to create a situation where the other side is the enemy, where you don't have access. You don't even have access to people who are likely to vote a different way. Then you're nowhere. It's really interesting thinking about the values that are imbued in conservatism and the values that are imbued in liberalism, and talk about the values. I think there's interesting conversations that can be had if you don't talk about sides. I'm so interested in talking with people about what they love and what they want and also what scares them. I think that those kinds of things, those are not sides. Those are opportunities to listen and to create space for new things to happen. Way more interesting than kind of declaring that you are on the good side and they're on the bad side.
I try and make sure I do that, of course. I had a real practical situation just recently. Everybody, I think, has heard one time or another about the governor of South Dakota, possible vice presidential candidate. But in her biography, she talks about shooting her dog. And whenever anyone wants to make a point of how she's on the other side, she's a bad person, they say shooting her puppy. It's a year and a half old. Because killing puppies is bad. Killing dogs, there may be situations. And the story, as she tells it, it was right after she was with her dog and the dog killed a number of chickens of someone. Well, I had that happen to me. Our neighbor, next one along the road here, his dog got out, come over here, and I had 7 chickens. And in a few minutes, 4 of the 7 were dead. And that happened back in 2017 when I talked to you last. And then it happened again a couple years ago. The dog got out and killed again 3 of my chickens. So a number of people who are good liberals say, you should have him put the dog down. You got to get rid of it. You can't have that dog. And so I understand the desire, like, well, maybe I need to kill that dog because there's all this other life and property that's a threat. So all of a sudden, I start seeing Governor Noem. I see her less as a horrid person, but as someone who's dealing with the same kind of issues I deal with. And all of a sudden, there's no taking sides, but I still have strong stands to take. There's much more we could talk about with Pamela Haynes about her books, Promise Right Relationship, Tending Sacred Ground, and the other several books. I don't suppose you could send us off with a piece of poetry.
Oh my gosh, I would love to do that. So this poem is called, Whose Woods Are These? There is the legal claim, of course, a construct of the Western mind that prizes private property. This claim seems thin, unnourishing. The claim of prior use points clearly to the Lenape, no longer in these woods, a grievous wrong that must be named in any talk of ownership. Then there's the claim of current use, the deer, fox, beaver, great blue heron, red-winged blackbird, frog, pine, hemlock, birch, beech, larch, mayapple, trillium, fern, are the ones to whom these woods belong through right of use. In the face of such a claim, I'm hesitant to lay one more, the claim of love. If I can love them deep enough in fierce humility, learn their names, come to know their ways, recognize the signs of their well-being and distress, walk lightly in their midst, take in their worth, perhaps then I can claim that these two are my woods.
And again, that poem is Whose Woods Are These? And it's from Pamela Haynes' book, Encounters with the Sacred and the Profane, a collection of her poetry. I'll have the link to bookshop.org on there. I have a feeling it will be a balm for the soul and an opening for your heart to get a hold of any of her books. The poetry, certainly, The Promise Right Relationship, which we discussed today, Tending Sacred Ground, Respectful Parenting, Money and Soul, all of her books are written in a way that can only enrich the reader. She's not going to tell you what to do, but she's going to help you see more of the spectrum of light in the universe and be able to live closer to it. Thank you so much, Pamela, for joining me today, for writing these books, and for having that wonderful heart that you have that helps lead us to a better place in the world.
I'm so glad. So glad to be with you, Mark. Thank you.
You'll find links on northernspiritradio.org to connect you up with Pamela Haynes and her books. We'll see you all next week for Spirit in Action.
The theme music for this program is Turning of the World, performed by Sarah Thompson. Check out all things Spirit in Action on northernspiritradio.org. Guests, links, stations, and a place for your feedback, suggestions, and support. Thanks for listening. I'm Mark Helpsmeet, and I hope you find deep roots to support you to grow steadily toward the light. This is Spirit in Action.
With every voice, with every song, we will move this world along. hope.